So, let's just launch into it.
I do not see my function here this morning as that of a gladiator, a bullfighter, a gunfighter, or any other kind of fighter, nor as a duelist. I come as a scholar to an organization of professional concern to all of us.
In his 90-plus years on Earth, Bernard Lewis has learned to take the long view of history, and in doing so, he has a warning for America and the West.
The main message that I'm trying to communicate is that we are engaged in a struggle comparable with the two great struggles of the 20th century against Nazism and against Bolshevism, and that it would improve our chances of winning if we understand who we are and who they are, what it's all about.
And perhaps more important, I think we all know that nothing that we say or do here this morning is going to have the slightest effect in the Middle East. We can change nothing. We can't even change each other's opinions, as we know from long experience.
Lewis says the struggle is between Islam and Christendom, two worldviews that contend that theirs is the one true faith.
What we can and should discuss is ourselves. Our own role, our own duty as scholars, our duty towards our discipline, towards our colleagues, towards our students, towards the media, and beyond the media, towards the general public.
And now the only obstacle that remains to the worldwide triumph of Islam is the United States. So that is the next target.
Our duty being to communicate what we have understood to others.
A conflict was inevitable, and the conflict has been going on for more than 14 centuries.
Samuel Huntington first published an article called The Clash of Civilizations in the Journal of Foreign Affairs in 1993. It incited more debate than any piece of writing that has been seen since George Kennan's X article in the 1940s. It incited more debate than any piece of writing that has been seen since George Kennan's X article in the 1940s. In response, Huntington has now expanded his treatise into a book, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order. He asserts that in the coming decades, the world will divide not along political lines, but cultural lines. The thriving Muslim and East Asian societies will challenge Western dominance, and a United States used to being a world leader will need to reevaluate its policies on foreign intervention and domestic immigration in order to remain a major player.
Hey, I'm Ben Shapiro with Reality Check.
Muslims the world over aspire to live with dignity and a sense of justice.
Wow, it's just like John Lennon's Imagine. Now, the question isn't whether Islam itself is violent. It's what its adherents believe, because that's what they act upon. There's plenty of violent material in the Old and New Testaments. Hey, I'm an Orthodox Jew. I read the Old Testament a lot. But believers in those particular texts are not currently ramming airliners into towers or beheading journalists or mutilating female genitalia.
There's no doubt about his guilt. Far-right militant Anders Breivik massacred 77 people in Norway 13 months ago to show his rejection of government policies on immigrants and Islam.
A conflict was inevitable, and the conflict has been going on for more than 14 centuries.
McDonald's Big Mac, the big sandwich with a great big taste that everybody's talking about.
The immigration laws of the United States give the president powers to suspend entry into the country of any class of persons. Now, any class, it really is determined and to be determined by the president for the interests of the United States. And it's as he or she deems appropriate.
In a way more important and also rather difficult, and that is that the Middle East as an area of study for scholars in the Western world presents peculiar problems different from those of most other areas. It is different from the situation in which we study a part of our own society, and that I think is self-evident. It is also different from a totally alien society, at least in its earlier history, its form of civilization. The Middle East is not like, say, India or China, which dawned at a fairly late date on the Western horizon and concerning which we have no important prejudgments, no inherited traditional attitudes or stereotypes.
Asa Pima Patalon. It is exactly as it is spelled. Can I tell you something? It is annoying. Don't understand.
Nor, I hasten to add, because this is important, nor they of us. The connection between the Western world, which for this purpose extends from California to the Soviet Union inclusive, relations between the Western world and the Islamic world go back to the very beginnings of Islam and have been shaped by a whole series of events, and more particularly by the seesaw conflict between the two worlds over 14 centuries.
There is, of course, a fairly wide spectrum of scholarly work that's being done on the Middle East, and of course the MISA Convention Program is evidence enough of this. Yet scholarly work in this, as in all other fields, is limited by contemporary social, political, economic, that is, contextual actualities. No scholar ever feels that his or her work is well known enough, and nearly every one of us believes that public tastes and what is easily accessible for those tastes miss the importance of a given area of knowledge.
It incited more debate than any piece of writing that has been seen since George Kennan's X article in the 1940s.
There is no abstract knowledge. All of it is situated relative to other scholarship, to the realities of distribution and circulation, to the social institutions, rhetorical traditions, methodological procedures of the field, as well as to the political interests and the facts of power and dominance in a given society at given periods. To speak about scholars, media, and the Middle East here and now is to speak first of the contemporary United States. And in the United States, it's also to distinguish first between the mainstream print and broadcast media and the fringe left and right-wing press. Second, it is to distinguish between scholarly work on the Middle East that effectively remains secluded within the various specialist publications and those views and images of the Middle East in wide public circulation, where they are either confirmed or refined and repudiated by scholarly experts. Roughly speaking, there are a small handful of essential thematic clusters in today's media coverage of the Middle East. One, the pervasive presence of generally Middle Eastern, more particularly Arab or Islamic terrorism, Arab or Islamic terrorist states and groups, as well as a terrorist network comprising Arab and Islamic groups and states backed by the Soviet Union, Cuba, and Nicaragua. Terrorism here is most often characterized as congenital, not as having any foundation in grievances, prior violence, or continuing conflicts. Two, the rise of Islamic and Muslim fundamentalism, usually but not always Shia, associated with such names as Khomeini, Qaddafi, Hezbollah, as well as, to coin a phrase, the return of Islam. Three, the Middle East is a place whose violent and incomprehensible events are routinely referred back to a distant past full of ancient, tribal, religious, or ethnic hatreds. Four, the Middle East is a contested site in which our side is represented by the civilized and democratic West, the United States, and Israel. Five, the Middle East is the locale for the reemergence of a virulent, quasi-European, i.e. Nazi, type of anti-Semitism. Six, the Middle East is the fons et origo, the hatching ground of the gratuitous evils of the PLO. Yasser Arafat, whose poor media image is probably beyond repair, is the ranking figure in this cluster of motifs, whose basic message is that if they exist at all, the Palestinians are both marginal and entirely to blame for their misfortunes. Now, as it happens, these motifs coincide almost perfectly with current U.S. policy. And as a superpower with by far the most interventionary force in the Middle East in money, arms, and political influence, we can safely characterize the United States, therefore, as being abetted in its policies by its media. How far this situation contradicts the rhetorical proclamations of a free, non-propagandistic press, I shall leave to your sense of charity. But that the picture of the contemporary and even the historical Middle East is misrepresented tendentiously, I shall not leave to your charity. I shall say it myself. It is a deeply flawed, deeply antagonistic, deeply uninformed and uninforming view that regulates what is covered and what is not covered. But to a considerable degree, it has worked, and this is the shameful part, because of the active collaboration of a whole cadre of scholars, experts, and abettors drawn from the ranks of the Orientalist and special interest lobbies, among whom one, the Zionist lobby, has garnered a vastly disproportionate strength, given that Israel in the Middle East contains only 4 million inhabitants. Thus, in every one of the 6 constellations I have identified, there has been a major role played in formulating and affirming the circulation of this reductive material by members of a profession and its friends who do know better, but who do know what they do consciously to maintain American hostility towards the vast majority of Middle East people, encourage that hostility in its ideological fantasies, hasten it towards less rather than more knowledge, sympathy, and above all, understanding. And it must be added, there has been no significant scholarly deterrent or corrective to these views in the media. Those experts and scholars who might have provided less distorted, more interesting views have either not come forward or have not been chosen by the powers that be. Some specifics are in order. As against the 6 clustered I mentioned, no sustained, meaningful, and undeterred exceptions to them are to be found in the pages of the following, and here I speak of news coverage and opinion: the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker, the New York Review of Books, the New Republic, Commentary, Foreign Affairs, the American Scholar, Partisan Review, Policy Review, the Atlantic Monthly, Dissent, the New Criterion, Midstream, Tikkun, Moment, and the American Spectator. CBS, NBC, ABC, and PBS, in essence, work within the same paradigm. Most of the provincial papers, journals, and TV outlets depend on the mainstream majors to a large extent. As a test of my overall thesis, ask yourselves whether any of you can think of a media outlet whose guiding principles vis-a-vis Middle East coverage include the notions that Islam is never to be criticized, that the PLO, while prone to a few excesses, is basically democratic and lovable, that one or another Middle East state besides Israel is worthy of unrestricted U.S. aid, and that Christianity and Judaism are basically violent, hypocritical, and depraved religions. Of course, no such publication exists, whereas in fact all the ones I've mentioned give unexamined support to precisely the opposite views. And why not, you may well ask. For after all, the media can call on a substantial roster of experts who regularly represent the Middle East for the U.S. media and U.S. policy. Note, and here I's must be dotted, that this roster virtually but not completely excludes Muslims and Arabs, although many are available. It includes people whose political sympathies are clearly inscribed in what they write, although, and this is the pity of it, some of the scholars persist in characterizing what they do as impartial or detached or expert. This is the point, and it raises the, to me at least, profoundly interesting question of how these scholars in the group continue to practice their art while remaining hostile, or at least antithetical to and substantially reserved about its central object, the religion and culture of Islam. The roster I have in mind is responsible for what is essentially the entire gamut of media representation of the Middle East. It includes Bernard Lewis, Elie Kaddouri, Walter LeCur, Ernest Gellner, Conor Cruz O'Brien, Martin Peretz, Norman Podhoretz, J.B. Kelly, Daniel Pipes. I could go on. I could supply you with a list of people who either could do a better or more informed job, or whose efforts to do the job have been systematically rebuffed. The U.S. media is, I would say, much more predisposed to hearing Bernard Lewis explain the TWA hijacking by a long, abstract, and general account of Shia history until the Middle Ages than in hearing about the widespread, ongoing debate between nationalists and supporters of Islamic tendency or between various factions within the Islamic tendency itself. The media is prone to welcome, I would say it is primed for, Ernest Gellner's theses that Muslims are a nuisance and viscerally anti-Semitic, that their culture and politics can be discussed in thousands of words without a single reference to people, periods, or events. Then they are in discovering whether there is a significant correlation between assertions about Islam based exclusively on classical texts, on the one hand, and on the other, what Muslims in various countries belonging to various classes, different genders, in differing social systems actually do. Never are polls done by Arabs and Muslims cited. Never are the old clichés that Islam is a political religion and that there's no distinction between Islam and Islamic life ever violated by history, reality, events, people, or production. Obfuscation is one thing, active insinuation quite another. Why do learned Orientalists lend their authority to a symposium on terrorism edited by the Israeli UN ambassador, if not, as Orientalists, to connect Islam directly to terror? And why, out of all the prodigiously complex, even painful realities in the 150 million strong Arab Islamic world and its history, do classical Orientalists find only Islam's poor knowledge of Europe and its anti-Semitism to discuss? Why are poetry, plays, novels, novellas, and essays never discussed? What has Islam become but a crudely and indiscriminately represented bogeyman certified by the Orientalist? Aside from the fact that expert scholarship of this kind, now in full view of readers of the New York Review, the Times, and Commentary, has no counterweight to oppose it, it is on its merits a disgrace to the world of intellectual production in the social sciences or humanities generally. Why is it that no prominent Africanist, sinologist, Indologist, or Japanologist speaks in this patronizing and deflating manner? The answer to conclude is that scholarly expertise on the Middle East has paid a very high price for its entry into the mainstream media and the halls of policy.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start, in fact, talk throughout about an essay and a book written by Samuel Huntington entitled The Clash of Civilizations. When it first appeared in 1993 in the journal Foreign Affairs, it had a question mark after it. And it announced in its first sentence that world politics is entering a new phase. 3 years later, Huntington expanded the essay, some would say bloated it, to the size of a book without a question mark. The new book, which was published last year, entitled The Clash of Civilization and the Emerging World Order. My premise is that the essay is better than the book. I mean, it got worse the more he added to it. So I'll concentrate most of my attention on the essay, but make some comments about the book as we go along. Now, what Huntington meant when he said that world politics is entering a new phase was that whereas in the recent past world conflicts had been between ideological camps, grouping the first, second, and third worlds into warring entities, the new style of politics, which he discerned, would entail conflicts between different and presumably clashing civilizations. I quote him, "The great divisions among humankind and the dominating source of conflict will be cultural. The clash of civilizations will dominate global politics." Later, he explains how it is that the principal clash will be between Western and non-Western civilization. But he spends most of his time in the two works discussing the disagreements, potential or actual, between what he calls the West, on the one hand, and on the other, Islamic and Confucian civilizations. In terms of detail, a great deal more attention, hostile attention, is paid to Islam than to any other civilization, including the West. Now, much of the tremendous interest subsequently taken in Huntington's essay, I think, derives from its timing rather than exclusively from what it says. As he himself notes, there have been several intellectual and political attempts since the end of the Cold War to map the emerging world situation, and this includes Francis Fukuyama's thesis on the end of history, which nobody talks about, sort of the end of Fukuyama, really, and the thesis put about during the latter days of the Bush administration, the theory of the so-called New World Order. But there have been more serious attempts to deal with the coming millennium in works by Paul Kennedy, for example, Eric Hobsbawm, less interesting and more rabid, Connor Cruz O'Brien, Robert Kaplan, and a book that's apparently making the rounds in campuses on Jihad versus McWorld by Benjamin Barber. All of these books have done so, have looked at the coming millennium with considerable attention to the causes of future conflict, which has given them all, I think justly, cause for alarm. The core of Huntington's vision, which is not really original with him, is the idea of an unceasing clash, a concept of conflict which slides somewhat effortlessly into the political space vacated by the unremitting war of ideas and values embodied in the unregretted Cold War, of which, of course, Huntington was a great theorist. I don't think, therefore, it's inaccurate to suggest that what Huntington is providing in his work, especially since it's primarily addressed to influential opinion and policymakers, is, in fact, a recycled version of the Cold War thesis that conflicts in today's and tomorrow's world will remain not economic or social in essence, but ideological. And if that is so, then one ideology, the West's, is the still point or the locus around which for Huntington all other civilizations turn. In effect, then, the Cold War continues, but this time on many fronts, with many more serious and basic systems of values and ideas like Islam and Confucianism, struggling for ascendancy and even dominance over the West. Not surprisingly, therefore, Huntington concludes his essay with a brief survey, not only his essay but his book as well, with a survey of what it is that the West might do, or must do, to remain strong and keep its opponents weak and divided. He says, "The West must exploit differences and conflicts," I'm quoting now, "and conflicts among Confucian and Islamic states to support in other civilizations groups sympathetic to Western values and interests, to strengthen international institutions that reflect and legitimate Western interests and values, and to promote the involvement of non-Western states in those institutions." Now, it's a very interventionist and quite aggressive attitude towards other civilizations to get them to be more Western. So strong and insistent is Huntington's notion that other civilizations necessarily clash with the West, and so relentlessly aggressive and chauvinistic is his prescription for what the West must do to continue winning, so that the reader is forced to conclude that he's really most interested in continuing and expanding the Cold War by other means rather than advancing ideas that might help us to understand the current world scene or ideas that would try to reconcile between cultures. Not only will conflict continue, but he says, the conflict between civilizations will be the latest phase in the evolution of conflict in the modern world. It is a very brief and rather crudely articulated manual in the art of maintaining a wartime status in the minds of Americans and others that Huntington's work has to be now understood. I go so far as saying that it argues from the standpoint of Pentagon planners and defense industry executives who may have temporarily lost their occupations after the end of the Cold War but have now discovered a new vocation for themselves. But perhaps because Huntington is more interested in policy prescriptions than he is either in history or in the careful analysis of cultures, Huntington, in my opinion, is quite misleading in what he says and how he puts things. A great deal of his argument, first of all, depends on second and third-hand opinion that scants the enormous advances in our concrete understanding and theoretical understanding of how cultures work, how they change, and how they can best be grasped or apprehended. A brief look at the people and opinions he quotes suggests that journalism and popular demagoguery are his main sources rather than serious scholarship or theory. When you draw on tendentious publicists and scholars, you already prejudice the argument in favor of conflict and polemic rather than in favor of true understanding and the kind of cooperation between peoples that our planet needs. Huntington's authorities are not the cultures themselves, but a small handful of authorities picked by him because, in fact, they emphasize the latent bellicosity in one or another statement by one or another so-called spokesperson for about that culture. The giveaway for me is the title of his book and his essay, The Clash of Civilizations, which is not his phrase, but Bernard Lewis's. On the last page of Lewis's essay, entitled The Roots of Muslim Rage, which appeared in the September 1990 issue of the Atlantic Monthly, Lewis speaks about the current problem with the Islamic world. I quote, "This is incredible stuff. It should by now be clear," Lewis says, "that we are facing a mood and a movement in Islam, far transcending the level of issues and policies and the governments that pursue them. This is no less than a clash of civilizations, the perhaps irrational but surely historic receptions of an ancient rival against our," whenever you hear the word "our," you want to head for the exit, "against our Judeo-Christian heritage, our secular present, and the worldwide expansion of both. It is crucially important that we, on our side, should not be provoked into an equally historic but also equally irrational reaction against that rival. In other words, we shouldn't be as crazy as they are. And of course, Lewis is very much listened to at the Council of Foreign Relations, the New York Review books, and so on and so forth. But few people today with any sense would want to volunteer such sweeping characterizations as the ones advanced by Lewis about a billion Muslims scattered through five continents, dozens of differing languages and traditions and histories. Of them all, Lewis says that they are all enraged at Western modernity, as if a billion people were really only one person, and Western civilization was no more complicated a matter than a simple declarative sentence. But what I do want to stress is, first of all, how Huntington has picked up from Lewis in a classical kind of orientalist gesture the notion that that civilizations are monolithic and homogeneous. And second, how, again from Lewis, he assumes the unchanging character of the duality between us and them. In other words, I think it's absolutely imperative to stress that, like Lewis, Huntington doesn't write neutral, descriptive, and objective prose, but is himself a polemicist whose rhetoric not only depends heavily on prior arguments about a war of all against all, but in effect perpetuates them. Far from being an arbiter between civilizations, which is what he suggests he might be doing, Huntington is a partisan, an advocate of one civilization over all the others. Like Lewis, Huntington defines Islamic civilization reductively, as if what most matters about it is its supposed anti-Westernism. I mean, it doesn't matter to him that Muslims have other things to do than to think about the West with hatred. But you get the impression that that's all they're thinking about, is how to destroy the West, bomb it, and, you know, destroy the whole world, really. For his part, Lewis tries to give a set of reasons for his definition that Islam has never modernized, that it never separated between church and state, that it has been incapable of understanding other civilization, all of them, you know, complete untruths. I mean, of course, the Arabs, Muslims have traveled well before the Europeans in the East, in Africa, and in Europe, and were great discoverers of other civilization well before Marco Polo and Columbus. But Huntington doesn't bother with any of this. For him, Islam, Confucianism, and the other five or six civilizations, Hindu, Japanese, Slavic, Orthodox, Latin American, and African, that still exist, are separate from each other, and consequently, potentially in a conflict which he wants to manage, not resolve. He writes, therefore, as a crisis manager, not as a student of cultures and civilizations, nor as a reconciler between them. At the core, and this is what has made his work strike so responsive a chord among post-Cold War policymakers, is this sense that you saw in, crisis managing prose during the Vietnam War, this sense of cutting through a lot of unnecessary details. You go through masses of scholarship and huge amounts of experience, and you boil all of it down to a couple of catchy, easy to quote and remember ideas, which are then passed off as pragmatic, hard-headed, practical, sensible, clear. But is this, and now I come to the more serious part of what I have to say, is this the best way to understand the world we live in? Is it wise to produce a simplified map of the world and then hand it to generals and civilian lawmakers as a prescription for first comprehending and then acting in the world? Doesn't this, in effect, prolong and deepen conflict? What does it do to minimize civilizational conflict? Do we want the clash of civilizations? Doesn't it mobilize nationalist passions and therefore nationalist murderousness? Shouldn't we be asking the question, why is one doing this sort of thing? To understand or to act? To mitigate or to aggravate the likelihood of conflict? I'd want to begin to survey the world situation by commenting on how prevalent it has become for people to speak now in the name of large and, in my opinion, undesirably vague and manipulable abstractions like the West or Japanese culture or Slavic culture or Islam or Confucianism, labels that collapse, particular religions, races, and ethnicities into ideologies that are considerably more unpleasant and provocative than Gobineau and Renan did 150 years ago. Let me give a couple of examples to illustrate what I mean. The language of group identity makes a particularly strident appearance from the middle to the end of the 19th century as the culmination of decades of international competition between the great European and American powers for territories in Africa and Asia. In the battle for the empty spaces of Africa, the so-called Dark Continent, France and Britain, Germany, Belgium, Portugal, resort not only to force, but to a whole slew of theories and rhetorics for justifying their plunder. Perhaps the most famous of such devices is the French notion of the civilizing mission, la mission civilisatrice, a notion underlying which is the idea that some races and cultures have a higher aim in life than others. This gives the more powerful, the more developed, the more civilized, the higher, the right to colonize others, not in the name of brute force or plunder, both of which are standard components of the exercise, but in the name of a noble ideal. Conrad's most famous story, The Heart of Darkness, is an ironic, even terrifying enactment of this thesis that, as the narrator puts it, the conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea, an idea at the back of it, not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, and an unselfish belief in the idea, something you can bow down before and sacrifice to. In response to this sort of logic, two things occur. One is that competing imperial powers invent their own theory of cultural destiny in order to justify their actions abroad. Britain had such a theory, Germany had one, Belgium had one, and of course in the concept of manifest destiny, the United States had one too. These redeeming ideas dignify the practice of competition and clash, whose real purpose, as Conrad quite accurately saw, was self-aggrandizement, power, conquest, treasure, and unrestrained self-pride. I'd go so far as to say that what we today call the politics or the rhetoric of identity, by which a member of one ethnic or religious or national or cultural group puts that group at the center of the world, derives from that period of imperial competition at the end of the last century. And this, in turn, provokes the concept of worlds at war that quite obviously is at the heart of Huntington's article. In the related fields of political economy, geography, anthropology, and historiography, the theory that each world is self-enclosed, has its own boundaries and special territory, is applied to the world map, to the structure of civilizations, to the notion that each race has a special destiny, a psychology, and an ethos. Renan said, for example, that the Chinese race, its destiny is to serve. They are docile people and they must serve. The black race must be the laborers of mankind because they're strong in physique and can work hard. That kind of... All of these ideas, almost without exception, are based not on the harmony but on the clash or conflict between worlds. The second thing that happens is that the lesser peoples, the objects of the imperial gaze, so to speak, respond by resisting their forcible manipulation and settlement. We now know that active resistance to the white man began the moment he set foot in places like Algeria, East Africa, India, and elsewhere. Later, primary resistance was succeeded by secondary resistance, the organization of political and cultural movements determined to achieve independence and liberation from imperial control. At precisely the moment in the 19th century that among the European and American powers a rhetoric of cultural self-justification begins to be widespread, a responding rhetoric among the colonized people develops, one that speaks in terms of African or Asian or Arab or Muslim unity, independence, self-determination. In India, for example, the Congress Party was organized in 1880 and by the turn of the century had convinced the Indian elite that only by supporting Indian languages, industry and commerce, could political freedom come. These are ours and ours alone, runs the argument, and only by supporting our world against theirs, note the us versus them construction, can we finally stand on our own. One finds a similar logic at work during the Meiji period in modern Japan. Something like this rhetoric of belonging is also lodged at the heart of each independence movement's nationalism. And it achieved the result shortly after World War II, not only of dismantling over a period of about 20 years the classical empires, but of winning independence for dozens of countries thereafter. India, Indonesia, most of the Arab countries, Indochina, Algeria, Kenya, etc. All these emerged onto the world scene, sometimes peacefully, sometimes as the effect of internal developments, as in the Japanese instance, or of ugly colonial wars and wars of national liberation. In both the colonial and post-colonial context, therefore, rhetorics of general cultural or civilizational specificity went in two potential directions. One, a utopian line that insisted on an overall pattern of integration and harmony between all peoples. The other, a line that suggested as to how all cultures were so specific and jealous as to reject and war against all the others. Among instances of the utopian are the language and institutions of the United Nations, founded in the aftermath of World War II, and the subsequent development out of that of various attempts at world government, predicated on coexistence, voluntary limitations of sovereignty, the integration of peoples and cultures harmoniously. Among the second are the theory and practice of the Cold War, and more recently the idea of the clash of civilizations, which appears to be a necessity for a world of so many parts, and indeed even a certainty. According to this, cultures and civilizations are basically separated from each other. That is to say, the core of Islam is to be separated from everything else. The core of the West is to be separated from all the others. I don't want to be invidious here. In the Islamic world, there has been a resurgence of rhetoric and movements stressing the innate opposition between Islam and the West. Just as in Africa, Europe, Asia, and elsewhere, movements have appeared that stress the need for excluding or exterminating, as in Bosnia, others as undesirable. White apartheid in South Africa was such a movement, as is the Zionist idea that Palestine should be for the Jews only and the Palestinians as non-Jews should have a lesser place. Afrocentricity, Islamocentricity are movements that also stress the independence and separateness of cultures. Within each civilizational camp, we will notice there are official representatives of that culture who make themselves into its mouthpiece, who assign themselves the role of articulating our, or for that matter, their essence. This always requires compression, reduction, exaggeration. So on the first and most immediate level then, statements about what our culture is, civilization is, or ought to be, necessarily involves a contest over the definition. That's why I think it's more accurate to say that the period we're living in is not the clash of civilization, but the clash of definitions. Anyone who has the slightest understanding of how cultures really work knows that defining the culture, saying what it is for members of that culture, is always a major and even in undemocratic societies an ongoing contest. There are canonical authorities to be selected, regularly revised, debated, selected, dismissed. There are ideas of good and evil, belonging or not belonging, hierarchies of values to be specified, discussed, rediscussed. Each culture, moreover, defines its enemies, what stands beyond it and threatens it, an other to be despised and fought against. But cultures are not the same. There is an official culture, the culture of priests, academics, and the state. It provides definitions of patriotism, loyalty, boundaries, and what I've called belonging. It is this official culture that speaks in the name of the whole. But it's also true, and this is completely missing from the clash of civilization argument as we hear it in Huntington, in addition to the mainstream or official culture, there are dissenting or alternative unorthodox, heterodox strands that contain many anti-authoritarian themes in them that are in competition with the official culture. These can be called the counterculture, an ensemble of practices associated with various kinds of outsiders, the poor, immigrants, artistic bohemians, workers, rebels, artists. From the counterculture comes the critique of authority and attacks on what is official and orthodox. No culture is understandable without some sense of this ever-present source of creative provocation from the unofficial to the official. To disregard the sense of restlessness in the West, in Islam, in Confucianism, within each culture, and to assume that there's complete homogeneity between culture and identity is to miss what is vital and fertile in culture. A couple of years ago, Arthur Schlesinger wrote a book called The Disuniting of America, which is a kind of cri de cœur about the way in which American history, which for him is the history of Bancroft and Adams and so on, is dissolving into something quite different. And he says that new groups in American society want the writing of history to reflect not only an America that was conceived of and ruled by patricians and landowners, but an America in which slaves, servants, laborers, and poor immigrants played an important but as yet unacknowledged role. The narratives of such people, silenced by the great discourses whose source was Washington, the investment banks of New York, the universities of New England, and the great industrial fortunes of the Middle and Far West, have come to disrupt the slow progress and unruffled serenity of the official story. They ask questions, interject the experience of social unfortunates, and make the claims of lesser peoples, of women, Asian and African Americans, and various other minorities, sexual as well as ethnic. There's a similar debate inside the Islamic world today, which in the often hysterical outcry about the threat of Islam, Islamic fundamentalism, and terrorism that one encounters so often in the media, is often lost sight of completely. Like any other major world culture, Islam contains within itself an astonishing variety of currents and countercurrents. I would say that it is this extremely widespread attitude of questioning and skepticism towards age-old authority that characterizes the post-war world in both East and West. And it's that that Huntington cannot handle and therefore resorts to the business of the clash of cultures and the clash of civilizations. Two theorists of that sort, civilization identity is a stable and undisturbed thing, like a room full of furniture at the back of your house. This is extremely far from the truth, not just in the Islamic world, but throughout the entire surface of the globe. To emphasize the differences between cultures is completely to ignore the literally unending debate about defining the culture or civilization within those civilizations, including Western ones. These debates completely undermine any idea of a fixed identity, and hence of relationships between identities, what Huntington considers to be a sort of ontological fact of political existence, to wit, the clash of civilizations. Too much attention paid to managing and clarifying the clash of cultures obliterates something else: the fact of a great, often silent exchange and dialogue between them. What culture today, whether Japanese, Arab, European, Korean, Chinese, Indian, has not had long, intimate, and extraordinarily rich contacts with other cultures? There is no exception to this exchange at all. Much the same is true of literature, where readers, for example, of García Márquez, Naguib Mahfouz, Kenzaburo Oe, exist far beyond the national or cultural boundaries imposed by language and nation. In my own field of comparative literature, there's a commitment to the relationships between literatures as to their reconciliation and harmony despite the existence of powerful ideological and national barriers between them. And this sort of cooperative, collective enterprise is what one misses in the proclaimers of an undying clash between cultures. The lifelong dedication that has existed in all modern and ancient societies among scholars, artists, musicians, visionaries, and prophets, to try to come to terms with the other, with that other society or culture that seems so foreign and so distant. It seems to me that unless we emphasize and maximize the spirit of cooperation and humanistic exchange, and here I don't speak simply of uninformed delight or amateurish enthusiasm for the exotic, but rather profound existential commitment and labor on behalf of the other. Unless we do that, we are going to end up superficially and stridently banging the drum for our culture in opposition to all the others. And we know also in another very important study of the way cultures work, the book co-authored or co-edited by Terence Ranger and Eric Hobsbawm, that even tradition can be invented. That, I mean, the idea of a culture and a civilization being something that's stable and fixed is completely disproved by this notion of how traditions can be invented, manufactured for the occasion. So the traditions are really not the wonderfully stable things that we are, but rather abstractions that can quite easily be created and destroyed, manipulated, and so on. As I've argued in several of my own works, in today's Europe and the United States, what is described as Islam, for instance, because this is where the burden, I think, of Clash of Civilizations thesis goes, what is described as Islam belongs to the discourse of Orientalism, a construction fabricated to whip up feelings of hostility and antipathy against a part of the world that happens to be of strategic importance for its oil, its threatening adjacence to Christianity, its formidable history of competition with the West. Yet this is a very different thing than what, to Muslims who live within its domain, Islam really is. There's a world of difference between Islam in Indonesia and Islam in Egypt. By the same token, the volatility of today's struggle over the meaning and definition of Islam is evident. In Egypt, where the secular powers of society are in conflict with various Islamic protest movements and reformers over the nature of Islam, and in such circumstances, the easiest and the least accurate thing is to say, that is the world of Islam, and see how it is all terrorists and fundamentalists, and see also how different, how irrational they are compared to us. But the truly weakest part, and I conclude here, or the weakest part of the clash of cultures and civilizations thesis is the rigid separation assumed between them, despite the overwhelming evidence that today's world is in fact a world of mixtures, of migrations, and of crossings over, of boundaries traversed. One of the major crises affecting countries like France, Britain, and the US has been brought about by the realization, now dawning everywhere, that no culture or society is purely one thing. Sizable minorities, North Africans in France, the African, Caribbean, and Indian populations in Britain, Asian and African elements in this country, dispute the idea that civilization that prided themselves on being homogeneous can continue to do so. There are no insulated cultures or civilizations. Any attempt made to separate them into the watertight compartments alleged by Huntington and his ilk does damage to their variety, their diversity, their sheer complexity of elements, their radical hybridity. The more insistent we are on the separation of cultures, the more inaccurate we are about ourselves and about others. The notion of an exclusionary civilization is, to my way of thinking, an impossible one. The real question, then, is whether in the end we want to work for civilizations that are separate, or whether we should be taking the more integrative, but perhaps more difficult path, which is to try to see them as making one vast whole whose exact contours are impossible for any person to grasp, but whose certain existence we can intuit and feel and study. In view of the depressing actualities around us, the presence of many intercultural, inter-ethnic conflicts, it does seem to me ostrich-like to suggest that we in Europe and the US should maintain our civilization, which Huntington calls the West, by holding everyone and all the others at bay, increasing the rifts between peoples in order to prolong our dominance. That is, in effect, what he argues, And one can quite easily understand why it is that his essay was published in Foreign Affairs and why so many policymakers have drifted toward it as allowing the U.S. to extend the mindset of the Cold War into a different time and for a new audience. Much more productive and useful is a new global mentality or consciousness that sees the dangers we face from the standpoint of the whole human race. These dangers include the pauperization of most of the globe's population, the emergence of virulent local, national, ethnic, and religious sentiment, as in Bosnia, Rwanda, Lebanon, Chechnya, and elsewhere, the decline of literacy and onset of a new illiteracy based on electronic modes of communication, television, and the new information global superhighway, the fragmentation and threatened disappearance of the grand narratives of emancipation and enlightenment. Our most precious asset in the face of such a dire transformation of history is the emergence, not of a sense of clash, but a sense of community, understanding, sympathy, and hope, which is the direct opposite of what Huntington provokes. If I may quote some lines by the great Martinican poet, Aimé Césaire, that I used in my book on culture and imperialism, and I never tire of quoting these lines. And he speaks here of man, l'homme in French. But the work of man is only just beginning, and it remains to conquer all the violence entrenched in the recesses of our passion. And no race possesses the monopoly of beauty, of intelligence, of force, and there's a place for all at the rendezvous of victory. In what they imply, these sentiments prepare the way for a dissolution of cultural barriers as as a kind of blockage between cultures, as well as of the pride that prevents the kind of benign globalism already to be found, for instance, in the environmental movement, in scientific cooperation, in the women's movement, in the universal concern for human rights, in concepts of global thought that stress community and sharing over racial, gender, or class dominance. It would seem to me, therefore, that efforts to return the community of civilizations to a primitive stage of narcissistic struggle needs to be understood not as descriptions about how, in fact, civilizations behave, but rather as incitements to wasteful conflict and unedifying chauvinism. And that seems to be exactly what we don't need. Thank you. Well, I think there are already all kinds of commonalities. I think the first step is to recognize them as actually having taken place. That I think also for me, the idea that cultures are somehow separate entities and exist all by themselves, with occasional interruptions by, you know, people with darker skin or whiter skin or whatever, is simply wrong. I mean, I think the first thing, and I think this is where education is terribly important, and probably one of the reasons why the conservative movement, not just here, but in most countries of the world, has something very important in common, and that is the constantly accented cry about tradition. We should go back to our tradition. We should learn our languages. We should concentrate on our books and our culture, that sort of thing. And I think that's bankrupt. I mean, I think all systems of education, alas, are still deeply, sometimes unconsciously, nationalistic. So I think we have to denationalize education and realize and make it possible for people to understand that we live in a very complex and mixed world in which you can't separate cultures and civilizations from each other, but in fact history ought to be taught as the exchange and, of course, the clash of civilizations. So I think that's the first step. And once you go from there, then I think we have a better understanding of the way certain kinds of conflict are wasteful and hopeless. I mean, ethnic cleansing, the idea of apartheid, all of these schemes for isolating people, and so on and so forth. I mean, I think it's fairly clear and straightforward. Alas, it requires a lot of work because you're bucking a very, very strong, entrenched position, which says that we are the center of the world, whoever we are. And all of what I've said is really intended as a critique of that kind of monotheistic position. What I was talking about was not, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I don't want it to be understood as suggesting that we're in the kind of attitude I'm trying to describe. I'm trying to eliminate difference. I mean, there's a great deal of difference between flattening everything out into some kind of, you know, univocal, homogenized philosophy, and so that's one possibility, and I'm obviously against that. I'm also against the idea of saying, well, everything is clashing and it's different and so on and so forth. And that strikes me as the major flaw in Huntington's proposal. I think it's a prescription for war, and he actually says it is. And third is the other alternative, which is what I call coexistence, but coexistence with the preservation of difference. I mean, in other words, that you be able to live with those who are different from you in all kinds of ways, assuming that there's a kind of, as the English poet Gerard Manley Hopkins says, there's a kind of radical inscape to each individual. There's this kind of different kind of construction or constitutiveness to all people in some way, and which applies to all languages, to all cultures, if you want to use that phrase. And so it's the idea of respecting the difference, but living with it. Human history is really a long history of compelling difference, either by assimilation or by extermination, by domination. And I'm certainly not suggesting that what we need is a unified and simplified and reduced culture that includes everyone without distinction. Everybody should wear the same uniforms and so on. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm really talking about the preservation of difference, recognizing that difference is all, but coexistence between them, rather than saying, well, we are different, therefore you have to stay away from us, or we have to protect ourselves against you, or we should destroy you. That's very, very dangerous. And I think there are indications, as I suggested at the end of my talk, in movements of what might be called a benign global consciousness, in, for example, the environmental movement, where environments differ, but they're all threatened, and they differ in different ways and have to be preserved and studied according to those differences, not according to some universal model. How to combat it? Well, I mean, this is one way to combat it, you know. I mean, is to reveal it for what it is, and to debate it, and through the various kinds of processes of education I talked about. Plus, I think, you know, one of the things that's very striking to me, as somebody who travels in and out of the United States a fair amount, is the fact that, you know, most American intellectuals are really not as conscious as they perhaps ought to be of how powerful the effect of U.S. intervention is throughout the world. I mean, you know, I think, therefore, the main duty for an American intellectual is to think about the responsibility of addressing this vast interventionary power, which is scattered all over the world, where U.S. interests are to be found. I mean, I think that's an important moral and political task that has to be defined. And in this period of basically inertness, where there isn't much debate on intellectual and policy issues outside, you know, the great think tanks and centers like the Rand Corporation and the Pentagon and so on and so forth, that seems to be terribly important. What are we going to do with all these nuclear devices that are secreted all over the country, and all these, you know, these B-2 bombers and et cetera? I mean, this is a vast military budget that is supposed to police the world. No, I think that the situation of the Palestinians is at this moment really quite, well, it's verging on the catastrophic, I'd say. I mean, it's not a happy moment. Not only is there really a quite crazy, in my opinion, well, egregious is the word I sometimes use for Netanyahu, but I mean, there's something quite bloodthirsty about it. And this is the head of the, as Mr. Arafat calls them, our peace partners. on the one hand, and on the other, you have the United States pretty much backing Israel. I mean, there are a few bleats here and there from Albright and a couple of others saying, well, please, time out on the settlements. I mean, the suggestion being, if you count to 10, and during the count of 10, you don't build any settlements, you're somehow being a nice guy. And then after 10, you can build all the settlements you want, which is the theory, I think. And supplying Israel with billions of dollars a year. They say $3 billion. There was a letter in the Times yesterday exactly about that. Say, well, why don't we say something to them about it? We keep on punishing the Palestinians. We withhold $100 million of aid and here for the Palestinians because they're not fighting terrorism enough, which means pretty much lock everybody up. So why don't we withhold some of the aid to Israel, was the question. I think it's a very good question. It's never asked. And then, I mean, it's a catalog of woes. And then, you know, we're at a moment in our history as Palestinians that we are led by, I don't know, words fail me, I don't know what we're led by, but not a very bright leadership. You know, going from one mistake after another without a, and there's a kind of natural thing that occurs amongst most people, that in times of trouble you don't want to change horses in midstream. I mean, and there's the leader, and we're beset on all sides, we can't move. The refugees have no passports, they're unable to work, they're unable to travel. You know, there's 7 million Palestinians in the world today, more or less, facing the same problems, some obviously worse than others. And the people on the West Bank and Gaza have lost, 50% of their income over the last 4 years since the peace process began. And unemployment is up to anywhere between, 30 and 60%. And houses are constantly being destroyed, and property is taken from Palestinians, and new settlements are being built in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is being Judaized. I mean, so in all of this, it's very difficult to say that there's much brightness on the horizon. I think it's a particularly bad period, which I'm afraid will get worse, because the leadership is very shaky. Arafat has very little popularity now, for obvious reasons. I mean, he hasn't delivered anything except problems, and he keeps rounding people up, as the Israelis tell him to do. And his men in Washington keep on conceding more to the Israelis, agreeing to more humiliating terms. And I think the main problem, and I think this will probably help a great deal in the near future, will be the clarification of what it is that we're all about. I mean, for years we used to say that we want to liberate Palestine, and then we say we want to liberate a part of Palestine, then we want sovereignty on that, then we accept autonomy on that. We don't even get that. So the horizon keeps shrinking, and people don't know what the whole struggle is all about. And until that is made clear, unless there's some kind of consensus, which is bound to arise at some point, I think our situation will get worse. And finally, it's been my, Iqbal shares the same, I think, view. It's been our view that, that the United States plays an extremely important role. And I think the view of most people, I mean, I'm talking about, citizens like ourselves, is that the situation in the Middle East, especially with regard to Israel and the Palestinians, is simply unacceptable. I mean, this is, the most extraordinary kind of flouting of the rules of international and even national behavior. Collective punishment is the order of the day. People are killed all the time. And, the idea is that Israel can do this and we can continue to pay for it. So what I've been surprised by is the absence of a movement in this country of people who are willing to take this quite important issue. And it's a movement, I think, that a lot of Jews have to be involved in it. I don't think it's just, I mean, I know it's Rosh Hashanah, so I don't think it's, but I think it's not something that you can turn your head away from, because this is done in the name of the Jewish people. And I think it's a quite important political and historical struggle. And at the bottom is a question of fairness and justice. Not of the United States, but of the, of the future of these two peoples who have to, in some way, share Palestine. But I think the role of the United States and the United States citizenry is absolutely central. Raise consciousness and asking questions, and not allowing these things to happen in the name of the West and the great and the good and the beautiful, without demur. And I think, if I might just say one more thing to my Jewish friends, that I think the crisis is a crisis of conscience. That is to say, until there's a widespread recognition and acknowledgement of what Israel cost the Palestinians, and that the present identity of Israel today is fundamentally intertwined with the tragedy of the Palestinians, one caused by the other. There will never be peace, because you can't continue to sweep away the fact that Israel was constructed on the ruins of another society and by the mass dispossession of another people who remain unacknowledged as just sort of obscure natives in the background, back to the desert, let them go to one of the other Arab countries. That's been the position. Now, we bear no... The Oslo Accords say specifically that Israel bears no responsibility for the costs of the occupation. This after 20 years, 26 years of military occupation, no responsibility. As an Israeli journalist said, he said, we took over the country in 1948 from the British. The British left us the port of Haifa, a road system, an electrical system, a large number of municipal buildings, and lots of prisons. And we could build Israel. Without that, there would be no state today. If we had taken Palestine in 1948 the way we left Gaza for the Palestinians, there would be no Israel. We destroyed the economy. We deported most of the capable people. We forced the people to live in hovels and refugee camps over a period. I mean, if anybody's been to Gaza, it's one of the most criminal places on earth because of Israeli policy of occupation. And they bear no responsibility for it. I mean, that's simply unacceptable, even for the Jewish people who have suffered so much. It's unacceptable. You cannot continue to victimize somebody else just because you yourself were a victim once. There has to be a limit.